Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Welcome to Noble Blood, a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey.
As you probably know, I tend to shy away from Noble Blood episodes featuring modern figures, not least of all because my aim is usually to uncover stories that haven't been told yet. But Princess Diana is a figure that looms so large in our collective consciousness, defining people's understanding of what it means to be a princess. It seems to me that in some ways, the tragedy of her story emerged at the tension between the modern and the traditional. Here was a woman very much of the 90s, trapped in an archaic institution. And here was a global population with a very traditional obsession with the monarchy, with youth, with beauty, with power, but now armed with modern tools, cameras and helicopters and motorcycles. The myth of Diana looms so large, especially in the wake of her death and the conspiracy theories that surrounded her, that for me, actually getting an understanding of the woman beneath it all was daunting. And so today I've enlisted the help of the brilliant Michael Hobbs and Sarah Marshall to join me. They're the hosts of the podcast You're Wrong About, and they did a phenomenal 5-part series on Princess Diana, and I am so excited to be with them here today. Sarah and Michael, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Dana.
Hi, Dana. It's so
thank you so
here.
Much for being here.
Thank
Dana,
you.
You're very good at this. That was like more insightful than anything we said on our show.
That's
like,
not true.
Oh, Dana's making some good points.
Mike's comments do not reflect my beliefs, but I do.
Sarah doesn't think I was insightful at all.
I think that we're equally insightful and that I can compliment you without chipping away at my own work, which is what I intend to do. That was beautiful, though. Thank you.
I think that you were so insightful, and I listened to your 5-part series that I immediately had to invite you on the show to do a Noble Blood crossover. For me, it's challenging because usually I work with the historical record and like with media. And with Diana, media itself seems like a character in the story.
Yeah.
Yes.
And there's like overwhelmingly too many facts and too much information as opposed to like, well, this is her hairbrush and this is what we think she looked like. It's also such an honor for you to ask us on because I hope people know that you're our royal correspondent and
Yes. You
have talked on our show about Marie Antoinette and Princess Anastasia. And is Princess Anastasia correct?
Yeah, she's
okay. See, yeah. I'm already tripping up a little bit here. But anyway, you have been our royal correspondent for a while now. And those are, I think, are some of our best episodes, or at least my favorite that we've done.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, well, this is just lovely. Well, I'm so honored to then have you back to return the favor on Diana, who, especially I think with the resurgence of the crown, has sort of reemerged in the public consciousness as like a fashion icon. I see influencers now in bike shorts and sweatshirts. Mm. I think she's really come back into vogue. What do you sort of ascribe all that to the crown, or do you think there's another factor in sort of the public interest in Diana reemerging?
Mike?
Oh, I was going to have you take this one. You're our maligned woman correspondent.
All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that the crown, the same way maybe that the People versus O.J. Simpson did, gave people a point of entry into the life of someone that they were willing to reassess or assess for the first time if they're Zoomers. So I feel like this is, you know, Princess Diana died in 1997, and so we now have a generation of young adults who either have no living memory of her or were born after her death. And so inevitably, at some point, people in that age group, I think, want to learn about what was happening right as they were entering the world, and then also learning how previous generations of media mishandled stories. I mean, I don't know. For me, that was a coming of age thing.
Michael, what about you? When did you come online in terms of understanding Princess Diana's story?
About 3 months ago when I started researching the series. I mean, a lot of the feedback that we've gotten from people are like, you know, I liked the series in spite of the fact that I have no particular interest in the British royal family. Huh. And I think that's like where me and Sarah came to it from. Like neither one of us are particularly like into the British royal family or
I mean,
into
I'm also
royalty
into
in general.
Royal history, but like I really have never, like when William and what's her face? Kate, I guess. See, when they got married, I knew people who got up at 1 a.m. to watch it. And I was like, I'm going to read about it on InsideEdition.com the next day because I'm interested and I want to see the outfit and the pictures and everything. But like, I'm not invested. Like, I'm invested in the Tudors. But, you know, being invested in people who are living their lives in front of you right now seems weird and it'll break your heart.
Something that I kind of thought, because I'm sort of on the periphery of that, of like really I am interested in the British royal family just sort of as a power structure and like the historical legacy of that.
Yeah.
But I found that Americans who woke up at like 1 a.m. to watch that, it was sort of like they wanted the pageantry of like an excuse to get dressed up and eat scones. Mm-hmm. Like they used the British royal family as mascots, as like...
Like Derby Day or something.
Yeah. Like it was just like a big... Which I think then speaks to the larger picture where they're more symbols than people. It's like they are an excuse to like play fancy British, which is a very fun thing to do.
Right. Yeah. And speculate on someone having or perhaps not having a baby and then what kind of baby and then when will we see the baby?
A good
and
or
it's
a bad
so
baby.
Weird. A good or a bad baby. What will the baby be wearing? How is the baby looking? And it's like, look at your own babies.
Yeah.
It's very much that they become mascots, at least to me, like modern living day mascots more than people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what makes it such an exploitative system. I mean, as we talked about in the show, there are a million reasons, economic, political reasons to get rid of the royal family, which like everyone kind of knows those arguments and they know the counter arguments and you can play that debate out. But to me, one of the most compelling reasons why the royal family is bad is just that it's a massive human rights violation to make people be in this system. Mm-hmm. And Diana is an interesting sort of vessel for that argument because she wasn't part of the system and then she gets sucked in. And you see all of
she
the absurd injustices.
In.
Yeah, yeah.
And
in a lorry on a lift, yes.
And it seems to me that Diana was very bad at being the quiet, non-speaking mascot side of being a royal because her sort of personhood kept jumping out.
Yes, exactly. That she understood the needs and the nature of modern celebrity in a way that the royal family, because as Tina Brown talks about in her book, they basically have these social mores of Britain 30, 40 years ago. Like whatever Britain was doing 30, 40 years ago, that is like their table manners. That is their etiquette for dinner table conversation. Everything is a couple decades old. And Diana came in, I mean, she grew up in a royal adjacent household. So it's not like she was some complete common folk, but she at least had something resembling the modern mores of British society in the 1980s.
She rode the tube, right? Like she cooked, she did dishes.
Yeah, like she knew what actual life was. The juxtaposition of what she understood celebrity to be and the kinds of celebrities that they thought they were is what makes the story so fascinating and also so sort of comical that over and over again, Princess Diana is just like, you people are acting insane. What are you doing? And because everybody around her is either in the royal family or these sort of footmen of the royal family, like part of that system, they're constantly just like gaslighting her. Like, why would you want to go visit an AIDS ward? Why are you doing this? And she's like, because I'm a good person? Like, why am I getting yelled at for
this? What is the reason? And there's a story where she was rushing to see a friend who was dying of AIDS at the time.
Yes.
And they were like, you can't leave because blah, blah, royal protocol.
Oh, yeah, you don't leave Balmoral on a Saturday.
Yeah, and it's like, you mustn't leave and you must curtsy to the queen 7 times and then face west and curtsy 12 more times or what. Like, there was this weird protocol.
Yeah.
And they're mad at her that she left to go literally see her friend on his deathbed. And it's one of those things where you can very easily put yourself into her shoes and be like, why am I getting yelled at for this? This is outrageous.
So here's my hypothetical question. And I'm not on the side of anyone in this. I mean, I'm on Diana's side because I think that she's a normal human being.
Yes.
But Queen Elizabeth's sort of like non-personhood has led like longevity for the crown. You don't shine bright, you shine for a long time.
Yes.
You can't be a flare because flares then go down. You just have to sort of stay at the medium level this whole time. Is there something to be said for this idea that, like, if Princess Diana had lived, that people would have turned against her? Just because figures who are not volatile, but just exist at all, like women who exist in any capacity with a personality and with flaws, like, the media eventually tears them down. Like, does the crown know sort of that in order to survive this long, you just have to do nothing, basically?
I mean, she would have carried on aging. So, yes. I also like that you describe Queen Elizabeth's career as like the oil at Hanukkah.
Yeah. I think that I really do think that is sort of what the role is to do. Say as little as possible and just continue on as like a steady beacon.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, well, and that also reminds me of speaking of the only way to age gracefully, or the only way to age in a way that the public accepts and doesn't get mad at you about. I think, at least historically, and probably now, you just have to do a Greta Garbo and disappear, right? Mm. You just don't exist, and then no one will yell at you for getting older, or for getting older in the wrong way, because every way is the wrong way. When Greta Garbo was in Queen Christina, there's a final shot where she's on this boat that's carrying her away from the man that she loved, who's now dead, and she's abdicated from the throne. And in real life, she was probably a lesbian, but who cares? And, you know, she's going toward her destiny, and the direction that she got for how to play the scene was like, just have your face be completely blank. Just think of nothing. Try to emote nothing, because then people will project shit onto you and it'll be perfect. And that's what that ending shot is. And I feel as if that applies to the career of Queen Elizabeth, both as a female celebrity and as a ruler with a kind of power. But I'm curious about the nature of her power, and I would love to hear about what kind of power you think she had throughout her career, and also as a public figure during World War II as a pretty young person. But I feel as if, if looking at her, that model seems to have worked, which is that you do as little as possible, and you also are as little as possible, because the more people are seeing their own ideas of you when they look at you, the more merciful they will be, perhaps.
I also think that if you do anything and have a personality that is anything beyond like Us Weekly idiosyncrasies, people will be like, why the hell are we bowing and putting a crown on you, a human person? Mm-hmm. Why am I bowing to a person?
Yeah.
I think Queen Elizabeth probably understands how silly the whole institution of monarchy is. And if you act, quote unquote, relatable like Diana did, it's like a princess can't be relatable, because why would people bow to just like the girl next door?
It's like they're rumbling the entire thing if people realize that Diana and therefore the rest of them are people.
Yeah. So I'm interested a little bit in going back and talking a little bit about her biographical information. When I was a child, my only understanding of Diana was a purple Beanie Baby that came out when she died.
Mm-hmm. I had that too.
Yeah. And I always thought, just as in my child head, like that she was the people's princess, that she was a commoner. But
me
she
too.
Wasn't.
Yes. Yeah. I totally thought people's princess, like she must be reasonably normal person, and she met Charles, like maybe they went to college together and they bumped into each other at the quad or something. Like that was the sort of narrative that I constructed in my head.
She was working at like a charming Notting Hill bookstore.
Yeah.
Oh, that would have been great.
So Michael, who was she?
But no, I mean, she grew up, like the royal family was her next door neighbor growing up. And because they're on these country estates, next door neighbor means they live like miles away, because they both have these like massive estates with like deer that they're hunting running around. But she went over to their house. They would come over to her house for various things. They were sort of in each other's orbit. Her great aunt was this sort of scheming royalist person who was like trying to arrange these marriages. Like she was very much a part of the royal system. And her dad was the Earl of something. And her dad was the Earl Spencer, not the Earl of Spencer, which is important for some reason.
Yeah, Earl of Spencer's fancier.
Yes, or something. Yes. And so she grew up in this royal system, and she actually, one of the only commonalities that she ever had with Prince Charles, like one of the only things that would have helped them get along, is that they both had these very similar childhoods where they had all this material wealth. You know, they had servants, they had amazing meals, they had horseback riding lessons, etc. But just they were completely emotionally bereft. That both of them had these parents that were absent and obsessed with protocol. Princess Diana's father would eat by himself in his sort of study, and then the kids would kind of scrounge for food in the kitchen. And it's just, you read this stuff and you're like, why? Like, why not just be with your kids for the night? But like, that wasn't done, especially if you're a man and he's like
Mike,
a single father at that point.
Parenting is for commoners.
Yeah. And so she's kind of raised by these random nannies who keep quitting because she's like really shitty to them. So they keep leaving, and it seems like
young
women.
Because she's worried they're going to jump in the sack with her dad, right?
Yes. And so she has this sort of rotating string of, you know, women in their early 20s who don't last that long. Her mom is living in London. They sort of go off to visit her mom after they get divorced. And this is like the closest thing to normalcy that she has. But she really has this like very emotionally empty upbringing. And this is something that like you never really get over. Just the fact that your parents aren't really there in any meaningful sense for most of the time that you're growing up.
Mm-hmm. And her parents being divorced, I think, is a factor that might have been in her mind as like a possibility where I think maybe for Charles, that's just like not a thing that is done.
Yeah, I mean, these people don't really exist in any sort of normal institutions. It's actually very strange for parents to get divorced and then the father to get custody. So
yeah.
It's very odd that Princess Diana's father gets custody, but the reason is because he's the Earl Spencer something something. The courts are just like, oh yeah, he's royal. He gets whatever he wants. Like, oh, okay. Like this is all the ways that this system has these weird little tentacles in the sort of official justice system that her mom never really has a chance to get custody of Diana and her brother.
That's a weird thing of the weird juxtaposition between modernity and this antiquated system that doesn't really make sense.
This completely indefensible system that makes no sense. And of course, the minute that he gets custody, he's like, okay, you're both now going off to boarding school.
Yeah.
So it's like, I really want my kids. I want to take them away from my ex-wife, but I don't actually want to see them. So I'm going to send them off to boarding school.
Well, he couldn't trust her to send them to the right boarding school.
I guess.
I think you're being hard on this guy.
I find it fascinating that Prince Charles actually dated Diana's older sister before he dated Diana.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How long and involved was that relationship?
This was like very much foreshadowing for what happens with him and Diana, that they date, I believe it's a couple months, but the reason why he stops dating her sister is her sister talks to the press. She has this fateful lunch with a journalist where she's just like eating fries, hanging out, chatting. And
it's like après-ski, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so she ends up telling this journalist, like, I don't know if we're ever going to get married. And I don't know, you know, I'm still kind of figuring it out. And, you know, I don't really care if he's the king of England or some janitor off the street. I'm not into him or whatever. And then the royal family reads this and they're like, did she just compare Prince Charles to a janitor?
Oh,
and
my
they're
God.
Like livid. And
how
so,
dare she imply he would ever do a day's work in his life?
I know. And so they completely cut her off. And so years go by before he sort of reconnects with Diana and then is like, oh, didn't I meet you once?
Mm.
But this is a sign of like how much the royal family
your
keeps
sister
things
had too much spirit.
Yeah.
But you look a little more broken in, you know, and he's holding a crop.
To me, it's astonishing how young she was when they got together.
Yeah.
What was she, 19?
19, and he's 32.
Gross. Oof. As someone who's 32 at this moment, that's weird.
Can you imagine hanging out with a 19-year-old right now?
I can't imagine marrying one, Mike. I can imagine hanging out with a 19-year-old, making them dinner, and gently slipping in life advice in a covert way. Can I imagine having a relationship with one? No. Oh, my God. And I'm like, we're just talking about the power differential of life experience and being like kind of more established and not being a member of the royal fucking family.
I know. And there's also this thing. I mean, I always think about the fact that both of them in the weeks leading up to the wedding were crying and trying to back out of it.
And it's basically just like telling, Mark and Sophie on Peep Show.
Sure.
I'm sorry. I don't. Yeah, go on.
I have not seen the show, so Sarah keeps bringing it up, and every time I'm like, okay.
Oh, you should watch Peep Show. It's
great. I
really
keep forgetting you haven't seen it. I'm sorry.
Like, Sarah, I don't believe you.
It's one of four shows I've seen in my life, like all the way through. Dana?
I've seen it, and I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, it is. It's a lot of crying. And like at one point, the guy character who's getting married, Mike, he's like, just tries to get hit by a car, but he's like too passive to really start a fight. So the guy won't hit him with his car. He just swears at him.
This is Charles. This right? is exactly Charles.
I'll just give you a couple really episodes to watch.
Yes. He doesn't really have the guts to truly back out of this. And he knows that this is his sort of country, royal, whatever duty stuff. And so he kind of sleepwalks into this marriage. And also Diana sleepwalks into this marriage. And it's just like everyone around them sort of knows that it's a bad idea. But there's this idea of like, you know, it's what's done. Or one of the big things at the time is that if he doesn't marry Diana, it's like, well, there's nobody else. Like she's the last one because she has to be sort of royal adjacent. You know, she has to be sort of lord whatever titled. And she also has to be a virgin, which is outrageous. And she has to sort of look the part and sort of have this trophy-ish kind of personality. And literally part of the argument is like, there's no one else. There's no one left. He's dated everybody else. And everyone else, like Camilla, has like had sex and like seems to maybe enjoy sex with other human beings. And like she's obviously ineligible for this. So he has to marry this person who like he doesn't like that much and she doesn't like him.
So, how like, many let's women go. Has he dated? Like how big of a pool is this really? Like hundreds?
My understanding is that there's two sort of theories of this. One is that he was kind of a playboy for mm-hmm. these years. You know, he's 32, right? So that's a lot mm-hmm. of years in which he can yeah. be dating people. And so mm-hmm. he has a lot of flings and there's sort of women getting payoffs and NDAs to sort of disappear into the night. There's this as a rumor, but then other sources will say that all of this Playboy stuff was something that was deliberately constructed by the royal family to make him seem like an eligible bachelor.
I don't
and
know.
He
I
wasn't
think,
actually
I think
doing this all that
loads
much.
And loads of women would date Prince Charles and have flings with him, Mike.
Well, that's the thing. We don't know. So like,
I know. I guess I think both theories are plausible because like, yeah. it's hard to know how charismatic someone is unless you meet them when they're like 29 or whatever. Like we can't go back in time and know. But like, it's yeah. I feel like it's a combination of like, I guess a lot of people would date the prince no matter what he looked like. Like there's only you know. Of oh, the yeah. whole country.
My hypothesis, based on just your interpretation and what I feel like, is both factors that he is not charismatic and not charming, but a playboy because people want to sleep with the future king of England, mm-hmm. and he kind of knows it in the back of his mind.
Yeah.
I feel
yeah.
like he has this deep-seated insecurity of like, I know people kind of only like me because I'm the heir to the throne.
But maybe also, you do know they're forced to like you, and maybe that's a kind of confidence. I don't know. Mike, I'm sorry, go on.
No, that's the thing. I don't know to what extent these people know how artificial their lives are. Because if you've grown up your entire life in that system, Prince Charles has never had a friend who didn't know acutely that he was going to be the king one day. Right. Yeah. So all of your relationships ever, every small talk conversation you've ever had in your entire life is with somebody who knows that you have more power than them or will in yeah. the future. And so there's nothing to compare it to, right? Like if any of us sort of got into the royal family and all of a sudden people were treating us differently, we would understand that as different. Mm-hmm. But he's just like, oh, I guess everyone just sucks up to you all the time and that's what being alive is. Like it's not yeah. true that they would have any idea that this is extremely strange.
Well, it's like how the super rich in America, you know, we have the like affluenza defense, which I forget mm-hmm. what that is supposed to refer to. But I do think there's kind of, I don't know if it's insanity, but you're like, you are less connected to reality when you grow up extremely wealthy because like mm-hmm. the material world has fewer consequences. Your parents like whisk away problems and hide them from you probably. You can just mm-hmm. buy your way out of seemingly anything. And I do feel like you might just persist in the idea that the world is a soft play area until it's too
late. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I always think of? I always think of Gwyneth Paltrow did that abysmal movie Shallow Hal where she oh. wore a fat suit.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
one day, the director made her walk around in yeah. a fat suit and sort of live as a fat person. And
I remember her talking about this on Oprah, like yes, it was on a social Oprah. Experiment. Yeah.
Yes. And the thing that she said on Oprah that I cannot get over is she's like, I would walk into a room and no one looked at me.
Oh, which God, is like, Gwyneth.
That's the experience of like not being a super hot blonde lady.
Or you know a celebrity. I mean? Like, at this point, she's been famous for years and years.
The daughter of Blythe Danner, famous for her entire life.
Yeah. So it's like she just has no idea what it's like to walk into a room and no one really notices when you walk into a room, which is the experience of like 99.9% of humanity every time you walk into a room. But that's never happened to her. So that to me is fascinating that she just doesn't understand what the experience of a non-famous, non-hot, non-blonde person would be. And it's the same thing with Charles.
I guess she was blonde still, but aside from everything else is different though.
Okay, so here's, I also think, like a question that, like, as a child, I couldn't quite wrap my head around. Princess Diana is beautiful and seems cool and fashionable and charismatic. Why doesn't Charles like her? You know, like, why? He really seems to resent her and just, like, doesn't like her on, like, a fundamental person level. And yet everyone else fell in love with her. What do you ascribe that disjoint to?
I mean, I think so much of it is just they're just fundamentally mismatched as people. The age thing is part of it. And because of the age, I don't think he ever sort of understands the extent to which age plays into this. But he always sees her as frivolous. Yeah. That she's not a sort of an intellectual. She's had years
not
of education.
Not like him.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, so much of his sort of self-conception is of himself as sort of like a thought leader. He's always been somebody who wanted to be more outspoken than his mother was. He takes policy stances on issues very early. And he's always thought of himself as like doing very innovative philanthropy. And he wants to talk about, you know, big global issues like overpopulation, even though like that leads to some really gross areas eventually.
Did you see that Dana and I both made the same face when he said that?
Just like,
just early stage kombucha face. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he really thinks of himself. He, again, because he doesn't understand how privileged he is, he doesn't understand all the factors that play into why people treat him the way that they do. He thinks that he's this like intellectual. And so there's this really interesting moment on one of their first royal visits when they're in Wales and they go and they do the sort of shaking hands thing and they do the line and she's on one side and he's on the other thing. And then he goes and he gives like an hour long speech about like the social issues facing Britain. And he works on the speech for days and he thinks that it's going to be like a real sort of coming out moment. I'm going to promote all these interesting ideas. And it's nowhere in the papers. Nobody gives a shit. And all of the coverage the next day is, what is Diana wearing? What did Diana say to people in Wales? Diana made like a 3 or 4 minute long speech. What did she say? And his sort of ideas, what he considers these really innovative ideas, are just completely ignored in favor of her quote unquote frivolous nonsense, like what
she's
wearing.
Which is her fault, obviously.
Of course,
she works at all the newspapers and writes all these pieces, and she gets the pictures of Spider-Man. I mean, I'm like, when I hear hour-long speech, I'm like, of course Charles doesn't realize that nobody wants an hour-long speech on anything, and that the beauty of a 3 to 4 minute speech that probably is what he considers frivolous is that people can follow it.
I mean, the Gettysburg Address is like 2 minutes. Right, famously.
And what was Lincoln wearing? We talk about that a lot, too. And he was a pretty good guy.
You know, it's also kind of interesting because, Michael, you brought up, like, what actually is the power of the royal family. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, like, in Charles' defense, whether or not he's a smart person, he's not, like, a politics professor at Oxford. He has no special expertise in this. Their real power is doing what Diana was really good at, which was bringing attention to things.
Yes. Mm. And like connecting with people and, you know, even the thing he always considered it very frivolous, the way that she would, you know, go to homeless shelters and talk to homeless people and sort of connect with them on
that
the
makes
sort of person-to-person
level. Seem like a cartoon villain.
Yes.
Well, this is the thing is because it's not sort of linked up to policy. It's not linked up to sort of broader social change. If you really want to solve homelessness, you don't need to visit homeless shelters. You need to sort of change the policy and change the funding and get private sector investment, blah, blah, blah. And what she understood is that, like, that's not really her job. Like, what she does when she goes to a homeless shelter is she is actually bringing attention to the issue of homelessness. And he never actually understood it, that you can actually do policy in this, like, backdoor way by just deciding which issues to bring attention to.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the tragedy is they could have made, in theory, a really good team.
I know.
Doing that. If he wasn't threatened by her and could harness and work with her power.
Dana, I'm curious about the parallels you see to Marie Antoinette, because this is something that I always think about when we're talking about Diana, which is like, here's someone who you know, grew up in this world, but not in exactly this world, and who grew up, you know, riding horses. I guess Charles rode a lot of horses growing up, but who wasn't expected to be important, basically, and then married someone who was almost defined by social awkwardness and just could never fit in somehow because she was too good at what no one wanted to admit her job was.
Mm. Yeah, I find the parallels really eerie, especially because, like, from all the records, Marie Antoinette was really good about poverty and, like, poor people on the ground level. She, quote unquote, I use the word adopted because that's the words that they used at the time, like, adopted orphans, which meant, like, paid for their funding, but specific people. Like, she didn't enact big policy changes about, like, the poverty structure in France, but, like, literally, if she was in her carriage on the side of the road and she saw a child on the side of the road, she stopped her carriage and was like, I'm going to pay for your funding for the rest of your life, which sort of is like the Diana approach, which is like, do this on the micro level, not the macro level.
Have a soft heart, be in the world.
And
the husband is like, no, we can fix everything. And it's like, can you, though?
Yeah.
But that's just, I mean, I don't blame Marie Antoinette for doing anything wrong, because it's sort of like what you described, like that was just all she was born and knew and cared about. Like, you can't, the last thing a fish can describe is water.
Right.
And it's the unfortunate timing of, like, people being racist to Austrians and people hating the monarchy at that time, where it's like, I think if people if the temperature of England was hating the monarchy at the time, people would not have been short of finding reasons to hate Diana.
Yeah. There's also the thing, I mean, they were in this weird place where sort of different people understood Charles and Diana's marriage as different levels of arranged. If they could have just agreed on the fact, look, we're not a love match, we're never going to be in love, but we could actually make a pretty powerful and impactful royal couple together. And so let's just do our duties, and Diana will be on the front end shaking hands, and Charles will be on the back end, like, bilking rich people for money to fund policy initiatives. Fine. They could have easily done that, but that would require both of them to be honest about what the marriage was, that it wasn't a love marriage.
And it seems like he has too much of an ego to ever want to be the behind the scenes person.
Exactly. Mm. And so he wanted, one of the really foundational things, and is very easy to forget, is that before Diana came along, Charles kind of was the Diana, that there's this famous trip to Australia before he starts dating her, where he goes and he shakes hands and he does these events and thousands of people come out. He was seen as a sort of the young, authentic, likable one, which on the scale of sort of everyone else in the royal family, he absolutely was. He was very charismatic compared to, you know, Prince Philip, for God's sake. But then, of course, once Diana's around, it's like you've upgraded, like, from a Honda to, like, a sort
of Ferrari.
Yeah, exactly. And so he all of a sudden,
and it's like, kids, do you want to take the Honda out again? And they're like, well,
yeah.
She just, all of a sudden, she broke the curve.
Right. And so he had this sort of glimpse of himself as the sort of the likable one, the normal one, the face of the new royal family. And then he's just completely buried under all of the coverage of Diana. And so he, again, if he was able to be honest about this, like, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? This all could have worked out. But neither one of them were able to admit what was really going on. And, you know, she still had this myth in her head that it was a love match, right? Like, she thought it was a fairy tale romance, and she kept trying to get back to that. And he always thought of it as a little bit more wrapped up in duty than she did. And so the different expectations of her and him and his miserable family were really what made it just completely unworkable.
Do you think the public at the time viewed it more like a fairy tale? It seems like the merchandising at the time was sort of following that narrative. Like,
Sarah?
Plates and stuff.
Well, Mike, I'm actually curious, like, do you know how much money this union generated just in terms of, you know, memorabilia and tourism and stuff?
Ooh, there's probably like a PhD written about that.
Yeah, because did you come across figures when you were researching?
No, because it's so hard to do the direct versus indirect. Right. Because one of the arguments against getting rid of the royal family is always that it would affect tourism. So some percentage of tourism is generated by, like, visiting the Buckingham Palace and, like, going to see all the royal sites, et cetera. And so people
and
would
bothering
have,
the guards, right? Everyone wants to bother a guard.
I know. And so some percentage of sort of visits to Britain would have been arranged around their wedding, and it would mm-hmm. have spiked slightly in the months afterwards. Like, there's all these sort of very difficult to measure effects of this, but it would be in the sort of probably in the billions eventually. I mean, the amount of stuff that you could buy with their faces on it. I mean, people have been sending us like random, like my mom and her cupboard has, you know, this like dollhouse that was like an official royal family thing, or like towels and plates, like
paper
the amount
dolls.
Of just merch was nuts.
Yeah. And also I feel as if they were considered important for the morale of the country, right? Yeah. Like what, like who will we look up to? Who is a positive figure? Like we're having a bad time economically. Like we need this, you guys. Like I feel like that's kind of the, I don't like, just from what we've talked about in the series, I feel like that was a feeling that was present. I'm also now wondering, because we just recorded an episode on John DeLorean, who had to negotiate with Margaret Thatcher at one point in his career because he was manufacturing in Belfast. I was like, did he ever, you know, maybe meet Ooh. Charles and Diana? Seems possible.
Not that I saw
it. I bet Peter Morgan's going to figure it out if he did.
I feel like that would show up in a DeLorean deep dive more than a Charles and Diana deep dive, because they met everybody. But I mean, it's funny. I was just watching Muriel's Wedding, which has a scene where the main character who's obsessed with getting married and with weddings is working in a video store, and she is watching and specifically watching and then rewinding and rewatching Princess Diana approaching in her carriage and getting out and the dress being unveiled, this gigantic dress. And I remember Mikey describing, like, it's just her little Diana and her little dad in her little carriage with her giant dress.
With like 27 feet of train.
Yeah, like packed in there, like when you order command hooks from Amazon and they're like, we thought you needed 75,000 peanuts to keep these command hooks nice and safe. And, you know, and I do feel like just having that resonant image of a bride, like I understood her to be iconic before I understood anything else about her. So I guess, I don't know. Yeah. My sense is that, like, no matter what your more nuanced attitude toward the whole situation, like, I think the general consensus was, like, these people are not going anywhere. Like, it is, even if I don't like them, it is unimaginable that they wouldn't be doing what they're doing.
It's actually very interesting to think about the ways in which, even as she critiqued the royal family and in a lot of ways revealed the flaws of the royal family, Princess Diana, I think, was also very important for promoting the idea of the royal family. You know, for more than a decade there, after their wedding, she was extremely popular, and there was a sense of, like, this is part of our national character, that we have this dollhouse with these pageant-ish characters that are going around the world and meeting with high-level people, and they're promoting landmine stuff at the UN. I mean, this does actually affect public morale. And a lot of it, like, there's sort of possibly not true stories of, you know, Australia thinking of trying to leave the Commonwealth, and then there's a visit by Charles and Diana, and they're like, maybe the royal family isn't so bad. She's very likable. And so these kinds of things do actually matter for sort of how do we think about this institution. And so it's interesting in that, you know, she was so critical of the royal family and the royal family treated her terribly, but as a symbol of the royal family, we finally had a likable symbol that, like, people were like, maybe we can wait a couple more decades before we get rid of this thing.
Yeah, that was a really, I think, fun episode of The Crown. If you watch the most recent season where I'm going to get this wrong and I apologize in advance, whether the prime minister or the president of Australia,
Prime Minister,
thank you, was garnering public support for leaving the Commonwealth, but people like Diana so much, he's like, well, I can't have this conversation now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they were playing that up a little bit on The Crown, and, like, that episode is, like, factually, like, there's massive factual errors in that episode, but, like, it is saying something about it's easier to sort of swallow the royal family when the main face of it is genuinely likable and seems like somebody who's, you know, down to earth, and, like, she is visiting homeless shelters and doing stuff on AIDS, etc.
She also looks like a princess. I feel like that poofy dress, that, like, shoulder dress and the literal princess skirt and the getting out of a carriage even. That, like, articulated, in my conception, the archetype of what a princess is for a long time.
Oh, yeah. She nailed it. Yeah.
I think it's really important that people need beautiful things to look at, and people want to see pageants, and we want to see, you know, beautiful people wearing beautiful clothes. And we will just, you know, we will go to great lengths to have that in our lives. And I think that if we recognize that that's a human need, we would obtain it in ways that are less weird.
The weather is getting warmer, so it is time to say goodbye to your jackets and heavy sweaters. Hello to shorts and tees. If you are anything like me, you have this urge around this time of year to completely overhaul your wardrobe, but ideally you want to do that without spending a fortune. Luckily, I found Quince. Now I've got a lineup of timeless pieces that keep me looking effortlessly chic year after year. They have these amazing European linen dresses, blouses, and shorts from $30, washable silk tops, timeless 14-karat gold jewelry, and honestly, my new favorite pair of summer sunglasses I got from Quince. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/noble for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/noble to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/noble.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
So now moving a little bit further in the story, I'm interested in when the marriage dissolved, which seemed sort of inevitable based on their personalities, as you mentioned, Michael. How did the public react? Who was the one that people blamed at the time?
I mean, this was, it depends. I mean, there were parts of the British establishment that blamed her. That, you know, the minute she did the infamous Panorama interview, she spoke to this journalist, Andrew Morton, for a sort of unauthorized biography about her. And she pretended that he didn't interview her for years when he actually did. So all the information was true. The establishment was like, oh my God, it's so cringy, right? She's talking about eating disorders. She's talking about suicide attempts. You know, this is not done by high-level royal people. How dare she? But then most of the public was like, hey, she's a person. Like, this is actually really relatable. And she's in like a shitty marriage with like this kind of trash dude. And that sounds like my life too. And so the sort of the people who quote unquote matter really blamed her for it and were just mortified at the fact that she was putting all this stuff into the public realm. But the subjects, like people in Britain, really liked her after this and like hated Charles for years after this.
Mm-hmm.
I read somewhere, and I think this is correct, that for a little while before Prince Charles married Camilla, you know, in the recent last few decades, he hired like a very famous, expensive publicist to try to revamp both of their public images. And so the way that he reintroduced Camilla to the public was a very, very controlled, systemic way.
Interesting.
Yeah. That, like they made a few appearances, not as an official couple, that, you know, like it was incredibly controlled how they reintroduced Camilla to not be the other woman at a point where they're like, hopefully people kind of forgot about Diana a little bit.
Yeah.
And then I just feel like the crown came out and they had to set their Instagrams to private.
Yeah.
People were like, hey, wait a minute. I knew I remembered you from somewhere. Yeah.
They were really trying to sneak back in there. So just one brief aside, what do you make of Camilla, both of you?
I like Camilla. The pictures of her when she's younger, she looks like this like hot, sporty, you know, posh lady. And I'm like, well, and then she married someone else. So it just like wasn't quite to be. But then, of course, she and Prince Charles, like, I mean, how soon did they start having an affair into the Diana relationship, Mike?
It depends on who you ask, but it's either like 4 years or like 2 years.
Okay. So like between 2 and 4 years. So like not, you know, this is a young marriage that is already sustaining, you know, some heavy winter weather, I guess. I don't know, in the form of Camilla. But it's just clear that they were a love match with each other. And I remember we talked about, you know, the Squidgy Gate tape where Charles is on the phone with Camilla. And I am a staunch defender of Charles against, you know, this idea that it is somehow embarrassing to say that you wish you could turn into a tiny man who lives in the vagina of the woman you love. Like, I think that's beautiful.
I will posit that there are intimate texts and emails and phone calls between every couple that would be humiliating if they made the light of day.
So if there aren't humiliating texts or like little or phone conversations or just nicknames or sexual concepts between you, then like maybe you could be communicating more. I don't know.
Yeah.
I also think, I mean, we did a dramatic table read of infamous tampon tapes.
That was disturbing for some people.
Yes, extremely, including my boyfriend. and what really comes out from those, of course, everybody focuses on the tampon jokes, whatever, but it's like a 45-minute long transcript, and it's a portrait of like a very functional relationship. And it's really the only functional romantic relationship that he ever had in his life. And, you know, Camilla's like, hey, what's your speech about tomorrow? Tell me a little bit about it. You know, the last speech you gave was really good. Can't wait to see the transcript of this one. Just basic, like, supporting your husband in his endeavors and asking him about his ideas. And
that's what it is to love someone, to be genuinely interested in their stupid speech that I'm sure is very long. But like, it's like you have to care about someone a lot to want to read the transcript of their speech on like the Welsh economy.
Yeah. Yes. And like Princess Diana was not someone who was really interested in that aspect of his life. And they were, you know, even as he sort of tried to spoon feed her and force feed her these pseudo-intellectual ideas, she saw that as a vessel for like really nasty behavior from him. And so she never really engaged with him on that level. She never gave him praise about like, hey, you did a really good job at your speech the other day. I read it. Like that was not an aspect of their relationship. And so in those tapes, like the tampon thing is kind of an inside joke, like a cute inside joke. And that's a hallmark of functioning relationships when you're generating inside jokes with each other and you sort of riff on the same concept with each other. And it's not clear that he was ever getting that from Diana. It was always this very formal thing. He could never really be himself around her. She could never be herself. It just never matched. And so those tapes are like really a portrait of a couple clicking with each other. And it's kind of nice.
I mean, once again, I'm reminded of Marie Antoinette or just sort of royal French royal family protocol generally, because one of my favorite things about Versailles, and Louis bucked this trend, but it was like a salaried position to be a royal mistress. And like there was money, you know, budgeted for that. And it was like, okay, new fiscal year for the royal mistress. And everyone agreed that like someone had to do that. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like this is one of those relationships where like everyone at the outset was like, okay, here are the ground rules. We're going to discreetly have affairs. I don't want to see this. You don't want to see that. And then, you know, just like if it, like their marriage is a career, you know, I feel like you can't, If your marriage to someone is your vocation, then it just seems like it's really hard for that to be also your primary romantic relationship. Like you have to be really strong going in, I think.
And, you know, that's another really interesting parallel between Diana, not a parallel, a point of comparison between Marie Antoinette and Diana, Because historically, the purpose, not the purpose, but an incidental purpose of a royal mistress was to deflect fire away from the queen.
I didn't realize that. That's so great.
It's sort of a Madonna whore complex, which is troubling, but was really effective, where people could see the queen as maternal and perfect and flawless.
Holy and quiet.
And then they could fulfill their needs of like gossip and like petty little like incidental talk about the royal mistress. And as you mentioned, Louis XVI bucked the trend. He didn't have a royal mistress. So all of that like petty gossip energy just funneled only to Marie Antoinette, where in another case it would have been, you know, distributed probably between two or three other women. Because as a society, we just culturally love talking about and gossiping about and diminishing
women.
You just
have to have at least one. What we've learned is that you have to have at least one woman in the public sector to just be like a spittoon for public enmity.
Yeah.
And then you can protect, you know, and then another woman can quietly, you know, not be loathed. But you do have to have at least one for people to hate out there somewhere, like a rodeo clown.
There's also an interesting thing with Camilla, because it's one of the only times that we have this weird sort of switching of who is the wife and who is the mistress. Because if you look at them aesthetically, Camilla should have been his wife and Diana should have been his mistress.
It's one of those American Hustle things where you're like, he's married to who and he's having an affair with which one? What?
Yes. So it's this weird, it sort of rejiggered the way that the tabloids sort of dealt with this, that Diana ended up being the vessel for a lot of the gossip. And Camilla was just sort of like this empty presence. There wasn't much to project on her.
But
and,
I think the benefit of Camilla, though, is people could hate her and then make Diana seem more saintly by comparison.
Yes, exactly. And also, I mean, Camilla didn't like Diana. Camilla treated her terribly. Like, I don't want to sort of be the you're wrong about Camilla necessarily. I think all three of these people acted terribly to each other and did not like each other in ways that manifested in
the way
extremely
people do
immature behavior
in horrible marriages. Yeah.
One of the academic articles that I read that I didn't get to bring up on the show was called, I believe, The Croning of Camilla.
Ooh.
And it talked about how in the press, whenever they would talk about Camilla, they would always unfavorably compare her to Diana, you know, like her beak-like nose and her wrinkled eyes. And it was something that every time they brought her up, they had to mention that she was like less attractive than Diana, right? And so it did make her seem somewhat tragic to me. That, you know, she's with this guy in this, like, pretty functional relationship. And yet whenever she shows up in the media, they have to say, like, oh, she's ugly. And anyway, he seems to really like her and they're in this great, like, blah, 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 right? It's just interesting that, like, that was something that they had to do. And I feel like there's something weird about just constantly being compared to somebody like Diana that I think would be really hard.
Mm-hmm. Especially, and this is now a transition, especially when you die at your peak. And never have to age in public, or you know, you can only always be remembered favorably.
Yeah,
Diana's very tragic death then catapulted her from global celebrity to icon. What even is higher than icon?
Yeah, symbol, goddess.
Symbol.
I don't know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think there are so many conspiracy theories around her death?
Because the royal family killed her using MI6 in the tunnel. Were we not clear on our show?
Did the royal family kill her?
I thought that was clear.
Yeah. Do they kill beloved private citizens?
I think my theory on this, like all conspiracy theories, is it's just such an unsatisfying end to this sort of larger than life figure. And then how does she die? She dies in a drunk driving accident. It's like the most pedestrian, quotidian way that somebody can die, and that just
and she wasn't wearing her seatbelt. It's like an ad that should play for high school students.
Yeah,
I know. And it's just like there's just something so kind of unresonant about the way that she died. It seems wrong, right? If you were making a movie about it, she would like kill herself, or you know, she would disappear off the face of the earth due to the pain, or something that sort of seems like it fits with the rest of her life, because the rest of her life was so sort of mythical. And then she dies in this way that like tens of thousands of people die every year. And it's like, oh, okay.
And it's like the most common way you can. And when we talked about in the episode, like where the idea was like, it's, isn't it weird that she died in a car accident, you know, with this timing, et cetera, or something. And it's like, it's not weird because people die in car accidents constantly in this country, like constantly. And inevitably, it's going to happen to some famous people.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like statistically the least
and
weird
constantly
way to die.
In, yes. In all the other countries too, by the way, in the world. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Michael,
and
you.
The conspiracy, yeah, sorry.
Oh, I was going to make a, bring up a point that you made on the, your podcast, which is so brilliant that I find myself echoing it almost constantly, that we think that significant events have to have significant causes. I think you brought that up.
Yeah.
The idea that like, because her death had such a massive effect on everyone, it seems like the cause also should be massive.
Yeah. And then you look at the actual factors behind it, and there's basically three main factors: that the driver of the car was drunk, he was speeding, he was going 110 miles an hour when he went into the tunnel, and Diana and Dodie were not wearing their seatbelts. And if any one of those things was different, there's a chance that they wouldn't have crashed or they would have lived. But you take all three of those factors and put them together, and it's just like a very normal kind of crash.
And then isn't it like the tunnel itself, like it just had this little like dip and this little curve in it? Yeah, that were just like
the tunnel
a trap,
basically. Yeah, it was this perfect thing where the tunnel slopes downward and curves at the same time. And so the driver was going so fast that the car almost jumped off of the road. And by the time the driver was able to sort of see that he was going out of control and turn the wheel, they had sort of settled back down onto the road and he overcorrected.
Yeah.
And then he just rams into this pole.
Which is how these catastrophic plane crashes sometimes happen too. We had this, you know, it was the Dreamliners or whatever, right? The, what was it? We had a series of high-profile plane crashes in the past few years, and basically I think what was happening was that pilots were overcorrecting because the software was malfunctioning and telling them that they were in a nosedive, and they were overcorrecting for that, and just, you know, overcorrection errors. Like, it just, it's so, and it's, I mean, don't you think that it's, like, really upsetting to realize that someone is not just mortal, but, like, that mortal?
Yeah. They're just sort of in the blink of an eye.
Yeah. And like a few like a few bad decisions happen. And this guy was like, I always thought he was like a little drunk, like he'd had some wine or something, but he'd had like several scotches or something.
Yeah, he was three times the legal limit.
Right.
He was like super drunk and he hadn't eaten all day and he was taking medication that amplified the effect of the alcohol. I mean, he was very impaired.
Yeah.
And you get into the details of this in your podcast. Was anyone more interested in like the specifics? I think that's a wonderful source. You also go into the fact that, like, he wasn't an actual driver for this
type
of car.
Yeah, he wasn't trained. He was, like, the head of security. He wasn't the driver. And the main thing to me is most of the conspiracy theories are around this tunnel that, you know, they flashed a light in the tunnel that blinded him, and then he swerved the wheel, or there was a motorcyclist in the tunnel, whatever. And the main thing to know is that there was no reason to expect that they would be in that tunnel. If you look at the hotel where they were leaving and the apartment that they were going to, there is a straight line from one place to another, and it's not the tunnel that they went in. But the traffic was so bad on the Champs-Élysées that they had to take a different route. But Paris is like a winding mess of hundreds of streets, right? So, so even if you knew that they weren't going to take the Champs-Élysées, there's 40, 50 different routes they could have taken to Dodie's apartment. So even if you were sort of the royal family and you were trying to murder Princess Diana, there's no way you would know that they would have taken that route. There's no way you could ever have planned for this. And there's just, there's also, people have talked about how it's just really bad to try to kill somebody in a car because you can't expect what the driver is going to do. Like, there's no reason to think that flashing a light in somebody's eyes would result in a fatal car accident. It would just be like, oh, it's annoying.
And then it's, okay, can you go into the basic conspiracy theories? Because, like, there's the light flashing, and then there's, like, general, the royal family did it, general, the paparazzi did it, and then I'm sure a small slice of, like, the Clintons did it.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton murdered Princess Diana, as we all know. I, piggybacking on that, I just have one sort of additional question is, why would the royal family want to kill her at this point?
The main reason that, I mean, it's actually a very sad story that one of the main purveyors of the conspiracies is Dodie Fayed's father, who has like a very sort of justified beef with the royal family and with the British establishment. His claim has always been that they're super Islamophobic, which like they are.
Yes.
Like as a general principle, like, yes, these are not people who are like super into diversity in the country. And so he has felt sort of shut out of the British establishment, which he was. And so he has built up
even
this
though
theory.
He owns Harrods, right?
Yeah,
like
even
he,
though,
he,
I mean,
by, if he were white, like he probably would be like a big badger baiting, you know,
yeah,
big wig, I mean, in the country.
It's wrapped up in like wealth stuff and like old stuff that there were deals that he didn't get. And there was like, they never approved his visa, which like genuinely is bullshit. That they just kind of left it at the back of the pile for decades. So he has legitimate grievances, but he builds up this idea that they didn't want her marrying a Muslim and that she may have been pregnant with Dodie Al-Fayed's baby. And so there was going to be this like royal baby who was the sort of half brother of the future king of England who was going to be a Muslim, and they couldn't handle that and they freaked out. But at the time, there was no actual evidence that Diana was going to marry Dodie. There was no evidence whatsoever that she was pregnant. The only evidence that she was pregnant was somebody took a photo of her in a bathing suit and she like has a tummy.
Oh no.
And it's like, she is a middle-aged woman. Like she has like a little bit of a tummy in this photo and they're like, oh, she's pregnant. And it's like, that's it? That's your evidence that she's pregnant? It's like one paparazzi photo?
Read every single issue of Star magazine. Yeah. Every celebrity is pregnant at every given moment.
I also like how you could speculate that that's evidence of someone like growing more comfortable with their body.
Yes.
And successfully, you know, being on the road to recovery from an eating disorder.
Exactly.
And instead they're like, oh, she's pregnant.
Yeah. So the sort of the, that's like the theory of this. The royal family wanted her out of the picture, but it just doesn't make any sense. And it especially doesn't make sense given that they killed her on that day, because Dodie Fayed had started telling people that he was going to ask her to marry him, but the first person he told was that morning. So if the royal family was really afraid that she was going to marry Dodie Al-Fayed, they somehow would have put together this mastermind plan in like 6 hours?
Yeah, those fuckers move slow.
And then,
they can't even plan a fox hunt in less than a month, I'm sure.
And they're bad at public relations. They're bad at things.
They're also very bad at things. Yes. So, you know, there's a million, I mean, I read 2 books about it. Like, you can go into all of the specifics. There's like a guy who was driving a Fiat that night who like might have been a paparazzi, but it's like they don't add up to anything. Because it's just like, well, what's the actual theory that somehow they knew that he was going to take this route? They faked the blood alcohol content of the driver. Mm-hmm. They convinced Diana not to wear a seatbelt. Like, if you try to put it in chronological order, what the theory actually requires, like, you just can't make it plausible.
It's like a lot of the OJ truther theories. You're like, individually, these elements could have happened maybe, but it's like impossible for me to believe in a world where all of them happen in sequence and where people actually manage to plan it behind the scenes.
Yeah, exactly. In like 6 hours, right?
They're
they're swapping out vials of blood.
There's all
like
kinds of telepathic communication happening in these scenarios.
Yeah.
People like just sort of unspeakingly, uncommunicatingly all carry out plans with maximum efficiency and discretion in a way that never happens anywhere else.
And you also have to imagine that if they have the power, if the royal family had the power to orchestrate this massive and immediate conspiracy coup, they would also have the power just to like have made Charles more likable. Like if they had the if they had the infrastructure to orchestrate this elaborate fake death, use that manpower. They should have just used that manpower to like make people like Charles a little bit more, to make him seem less of like a little bit of a wet blanket.
Or like they could have blocked the Panorama interview.
Yeah.
Like they could have stopped the publication of this tell-all biography. Like there's many smaller steps they could have taken.
Yeah, they actually only have power to murder.
Diana.
To make her
only murder.
To make her look like less likable also. Like I mean, her death is a human tragedy, obviously, but on a larger scale, it made people love Diana more than they ever had.
That's the thing.
Oh,
yeah, exactly. Which they surely would have foreseen if they can arrange like a 7-hour murder conspiracy in 2 languages. They probably could have foreseen that this would make her more popular eventually. Yeah.
So, you know, with Diana having been dead for, over 2 decades, where do you think her legacy sort of stands now, just in your professional private opinions?
I mean, I feel like The Crown has left people with a chance to feel like they have a firsthand experience of kind of the compressed storyline of her marriage and life and divorce and death. Mm. And it seems as if, you know, that's giving people a new access point with which to love her. Like, I think that, like, Marie Antoinette or any number of figures who have endured, especially after an untimely passing, I think there is, she was able to interact with the press or with the forms of media that recorded her life in a way that I think gave people at the time and continues to give them a feeling like they have some real connection with who she was. Like, I think what made her great at what she did was that, you know, despite all the performance, despite the great pain of her life a lot of the time, I feel like she did, I hate to use this word because it's just been, it's so gross now in the age of influencer culture, but like, she kind of maybe was one of the people who helped invent authenticity as we know it today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah, do you think, I am trying to come up with the most articulate way to ask this. People tend to fundamentally hate women in power for a variety of reasons. Do you think that part of the reason Diana was so beloved was because she was vulnerable and tragic? Do you think there was a victim aspect to why she was able to remain so beloved? And I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would say yes. And I feel like my first memory of thinking critically about Diana was listening to the version of Candle in the Wind that was rewritten in tribute to her. And then realizing soon after that that was a rewritten version of a song originally about Marilyn Monroe. And I was like, that's kind of odd. I just think that's odd to have some other girl's song rewritten for you. I don't know why I'm bothered by that. I just am. I know it's hard to write a new song, but it does feel like it expresses this thing of like, I mean, it's like Mike and I just recorded on Miss America, and I keep thinking of that because a lot of the themes are the same. Like, she must be a virgin. She must be, you know, this age and this, you know, all these other qualifiers. And we were talking about how it feels like, it feels to me like when you are anointed and crowned Miss America, like you were the human carrier of the spirit of Miss America. And then, you know, you show up the next year and give the crown away, and then your little husk crumbles and blows away in the wind and falls into the beach on Atlantic City and is washed away by the surf. And then you become a mermaid.
It's very poetic.
Yeah, I think that's what happens. And that's why you never see them again. But just this, it feels like that song being kind of rewritten and reused fits with this idea that we have a society that just consumes women and that we somehow apologize for it by selectively mourning some of them. Mm. And that Marilyn was one who was consumed by the fame machine and Princess Diana became, you know, another. And it was just, she was consumed by more, you know, the royal family and British tabloids than by the Hollywood treadmill or whatever it was. And her presence is one that I think carries us potentially into really meaningful experiences of thoughtfulness and empathy, but she's also very accessible because she is kind of poured into the mold that we are most conditioned to find sympathetic and lovable, partly because, you know, there's nothing less intimidating than a woman who's already dead. Like, there's a reason why so many of our beloved young women in society are murder victims. You know, they're not very uppity, are they?
And it's also like the media then loves this idea of like, oh, we all killed her.
Yes.
Oh my God.
The mea culpa, the self-flagellation of the mea culpa, I think is an instinct that everyone kind of likes to indulge in.
Let's not blame the very specific tabloids and very specific editors who were like buying photos of her that were taken at night and clearly invasive. Like, no. Let's not blame the people who actually made decisions. Let's blame everyone who ever
bought a magazine. It was you, Mabel.
Like, no.
Mabel Jenkins.
Let's blame literally everybody instead of like the 8 people who actually made her life terrible.
No, it was all of us. It was society.
I think my big thing with Diana is, you know, you can talk about the authenticity in this sort of clinical way, but, you know, one of the things we mentioned on the show was that diagnoses of bulimia, I believe, quadrupled in Britain in the early 1990s once she started talking about this, because people were finally getting diagnosed. People were finally talking about it. And I think, to me, as somebody who lived in Europe for 11 years, I lived in Britain, there's a huge problem with sort of official aristocratic European society that does not talk about stuff. And this was one of the things that Diana really struggled with, that she would go to these dinner parties and you're not allowed to talk about anything real. You're not allowed to reveal anything of yourself. You just make this excruciating superficial small talk for hours and hours, and it never ends. And I think one of the things that she really did was break that habit and point out that, like, this isn't serving anybody. Like, who is it helping for us not to talk about what we're struggling with? Why would we do this to ourselves? Why do we raise our kids this way, right? And so I just think that it's a model that the solution to the things that Diana struggled with in her life is not to push them under the rug. It's to bring them out into the light and talk about how you're not a broken person for struggling with an eating disorder. You're not a broken person for, like, still dealing with the trauma of your weird, cold upbringing and your terrible sandwiches. Like, you're allowed to talk about this stuff. And so I just think if there's a model, it's really like bringing things into the light and talking about yourself as a whole person, that you are beautiful and you wear these outfits and everything. Like, you can talk about the sparkly stuff, but you can also talk about the dark stuff, and that doesn't take away, and one thing doesn't take away from the other.
That's beautifully said. And I also want to go on the record finally and say, like, I reject the dichotomy that people who are interested in like fashion and clothes are automatically frivolous.
That, like,
Like, I think her fashion is interesting and worth, as worth talking about as Prince Charles's non-expertise on Welsh economic policy.
Straight men are interested in sports.
Yeah.
There is nothing more frivolous than, like, knowing sports statistics. Like, you're not going to talk shit on somebody who knows the names of a couple designers if you can tell me what, like, Cal Ripken hit in 1984 or whatever. Sorry, it's all frivolous. You don't get to talk shit on other people's frivolous stuff.
Also, I gotta say, I don't know how men look in England. Maybe they look great. Who knows? In America, men look awful. And so many of them could just learn how to dress better, just a little bit, just 5 to 10% better. Because, like, quality menswear is a beautiful thing. Like, men can dress gorgeously. Like, watch Robert De Niro in Casino if you want my point to be probably proved to you.
So not the movie I thought you were going to bring up as an example.
Yeah, not the best dressed men I might
think. I think, listen, Robert De Niro has more costume changes in that movie than Sharon Stone. And I think he's probably accessible on the scale of masculinity. But he wears, like, beautiful, loud suits. But the point is that, like, men could look so much better and have so much of the passive power that comes from looking good, but they're just terrified of it. And it's hilarious to me because you could just, you know, it's right there in front of you, but you're afraid of taking it.
And I argue, if you're rich, it's pretty easy to be hot.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
you just hire a couple people. Yeah. You're like, tell me, give me a skincare routine, dress me, give me a capsule wardrobe. Thank you.
Yeah. So on that note, before we go, I do want to ask each of you what your favorite iconic Diana fashion moment is.
Ooh.
Do you have a favorite Diana look that comes to mind?
I know what Sarah's going to say.
Do you? I think you do. Yeah. Okay. So my favorite look is that picture you showed me, Mike, where she's wearing mom jeans and a t-shirt. Yeah, I knew you knew.
The when Des Moines wine mom, yeah.
When was that? I think I said Duluth, but either way, when was that photo taken?
That was right after the divorce. So I believe 94.
Yeah, and they, and of course these weren't mom jeans at the time. These were very fashionable jeans of the kind that, you know, Meg Ryan was wearing in 1994. But she's wearing, like, high cut, you know, just like, but it is, it's like a very, like, Meg Ryan kind of a look. It's like, these are my jeans, I am a mom. And then, like, you know, and I'm sure these were all made by designers. And then a t-shirt with stars on it. And she just looks like she could be the former Princess of Wales, or she could be, like, the prettiest mom in Duluth, Minnesota, like, picking up her kids from gymnastics.
If I want to Google, if I want to Google this picture, what do you think what's the best, most effective search?
Mom jeans. I think, honestly, Princess Diana mom jeans.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Diana Mom Jeans, star t-shirt.
And she's like walking downstairs. It's a white t-shirt.
Yeah.
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 Totally. She looks like she could be at the Mall of America.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love it.
We mean that in the best possible way.
Oh, yeah. I wish I was in Minnesota right now.
Yeah. I am a huge fan of Duluth Wine Moms.
And she looks better than any of us could trying to be a Duluth Wine Mom.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And just that she's like that. I mean, I know that Mom Jeans has acquired a pejorative connotation. I think that's unfair. And I feel as if, like, this is a picture of her being a mom, which is an opportunity she was really deprived of for a lot of her marriage.
Mm-hmm. That is a good segue. I'm superseding you, Michael, and doing mine now. A Ooh. Look that I love because it feels very 2020 or, like, 2021. Mm-hmm. Also sort of a mom jean, like a light wash jean, boots, brown boots, a crew neck sweatshirt, a blazer, mm-hmm. and a hat.
Oh, I know the photo. Yeah.
It's like a balloon on her mm-hmm. shirt. I think she's also with William.
The British Lung Foundation.
Oh, yeah. There we go. British Lung mm-hmm. Foundation. Yeah. She just looks very sporty and like chic, but casual in a way that I wish I could emulate. And it feels very modern. I think even like, I was going to say Hilaria Baldwin. Who's Justin Bieber's wife?
Haley Bieber.
I think Haley Bieber recreated some of these looks for like a fashion spread.
Oh, that's great.
And
Diana
it looks really good.
A white sweatshirt. She's got a lot of good sweatshirt looks.
Also, she's wearing a white sweatshirt under a blazer with a baseball cap on. Like, this is like Billy Crystal at a baseball game almost. Mm-hmm. Like, but she, and it's like, she knew how to put items together, didn't she?
She was also really good in the look of like a crew neck sweatshirt with bike shorts.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
She looked really good doing that.
I think this is such a cliche, but mine would be the infamous revenge dress.
Oh, and please describe the context of the revenge dress to those who might be unfamiliar.
This is why I think it's so important, because I don't know that much about fashion. I can't say much about the actual dress itself, but it's such a metaphor for the way that women can use fashion as power. So the entire thing was Prince Charles was on this sort of PR kick. He was doing a documentary for the BBC that was supposed to like humanize him and make him seem cool and down to earth and authentic. And I have seen it and it does not do any of those things, but he was convinced that it would. And so Diana had gotten this invitation to go to the Serpentine Gallery and she had turned it down, whatever, I'm busy that night. She finds out this BBC documentary is airing and she's like, on second thought, I am going to go. And she shows up in this crackerjack knockout black dress with like shoulders out and this big necklace. And she just looks like a billion bucks. Mm-hmm. And she did this deliberately to knock Prince Charles off the front pages. She wanted to take the nation's attention away from him and put it on her. And it worked. All of the front pages the next day are like, knock out Diana. And Prince Charles is on like page 17, just like his dumb Welsh speech.
Prince Charles
and she's like,
said some words.
And it's like, I can still do this. And I just think it's like, it's such a moment of her understanding herself as a symbol in ways that she mm-hmm. didn't at the beginning of the marriage, in ways that she didn't at the beginning of her career. She's like, this is the way that I can communicate with the public. This is the way that I can get my message across. Sometimes it's literally just me showing up to something in a dress. That is enough. And so to me, it's just such a confidence moment.
Her totally understanding and using the power that people ascribe to her, gave to her.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And it's so rare to see a woman do that. And sort of, you know, women throughout her life, she was criticized for being frivolous. Like, oh, she's always shopping and she's doing all this fashion stuff. And it's like, that's literally her job. Like, it's absurd to criticize her for understanding her job. Like,
achieve peace in the Falklands?
Yes, exactly. And she's going to these events where she has to change into different formal clothes 3 or 4 times a day. So that requires a lot of shopping. Like, you just have to have a lot of dresses for that.
Also, that's the thing that people were writing about her and talking about her a lot. In interviews, no one was asking her take on the Falklands because she's not an expert on the Falklands.
Yes. She's like this random woman, basically, who like shows up at things. It's fine.
Yeah.
And so this was a rare moment of a woman in public life actually using that kind of scrutiny to send a message. And it's just like a nice little power moment.
I love that. I think that is a perfect place to end. Sarah, Michael, thank you so much for joining me. Where can people find you on the internet if they're inclined to hear more of your wisdom and perspective?
Our podcast is on all of your major podcast apps. It's called You're Wrong About, and you can find Sarah also on Why Are Dads, which is
and
also
you can
on your telephone.
Find Mike also on Maintenance Phase.
You know?
Yeah. And so, you've Googling. Talked about Dr. Oz recently. I've talked about The Dark Knight recently. Mm-hmm. We have a few other interests sometimes.
Yes.
Perfect. And I think both dads and the public obsession with weight and bodies also feeds into the Diana issue. So this is all a topical.
She had
bubble.
A dad and she was on diets, you know?
Well, thank you so much for joining me. Have a good one. How do people sign off of these things? I'm usually talking alone to myself in a closet.
Fare thee well, Dana.
I know. Bless you. God bless Princess Diana.
Yeah. Bless. God bless us, everyone.
Everyone. Yes. Perfect.
Noble Blood is a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. The show is written and hosted by Dana Schwartz and produced by Aaron Mankey, Matt Frederick, Alex Williams, and Trevor Young. Noble Blood is on social media at Noble Blood Tales, and you can learn more about the show over at NobleBloodTales.com. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.